What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Michael Phillips. Is this it, Josh, the Pope's new army?
No, Michael. You swore this was a battle between warriors. So warriors is what I brought.
On my challenge, by the ancient laws of combat, we are met at this chosen ground to settle for good and all. Who holds sway over the 5 points?
Is the cleaver really necessary, Michael?
Maybe you should just go back to where you came from, Josh.
You mean the Chicago suburbs?
That's right. That's right. I'll go back to Racine.
There we go. This week on the show, Michael and I and our respective gangs of New York leave the 5 points for an exploration of immigration in the movies. We've got a review of James Gray's The Immigrant and our top 5 movies about immigration. That and more ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 1 million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 20% off footage clips for new accounts, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM614. You are listening to Film Spotting with the Chicago Tribune's Michael the Butcher Phillips in for Adam this week. I'm Josh Larson. Michael will defend his turf later in the show when we share our top 5 movies about immigrants. Also coming up, some quick thoughts on Tom Cruise in Edge of Tomorrow and the How to Train Your Dragon sequel. But first, we check in at Ellis Island for a review of James Gray's The Immigrant.
Welcome to the United States of America. Next.
Your name, please.
Eva Sibushka. She's my sister. Is something wrong?
She has to be deported.
No! We'll never go back!
You speak English?
Yes. Can you help me? Please.
You're a very lucky lady. Do you have a place to stay?
Do you know somewhere?
Yeah, I know a place. And get her off the island, whether she's cured or not. I know people. Be difficult and costly, but it can be done.
I need to work.
Well, I can take you to my place of business.
That's Joaquin Phoenix playing someone who's posing as a member of the Travelers Aid Society. He's actually a Lower East Side charlatan and scam artist, and worse, in James Gray's film The Immigrant. It's really about the American dream, I think, Josh, and of course a million different movies and novels and all kinds of works of popular fiction tech on that subject, and it's a myth, a long-held promise, a cliche, and an endlessly renewable resource, this idea of the American dream in popular fiction. And Gray has embraced it and questioned it, I think, in all of his movies to one degree or another. His latest film is set in 1921. Fresh off the boat, two Polish immigrants, sisters, find a full complement of heartache the second they hit Ellis Island when one sister, Magda, is quarantined with bad lungs, possibly TB, and the other sister, Ava, played by Marianne Cotillard, is alone, desperate, and it turns out easy prey for the Lower East Side theatrical impresario, pimp, and American go-getter played by Phoenix. As Ava falls into prostitution in order to raise money to get her sister off the island before she's deported, Phoenix's character reveals himself to be a more conflicted snake than he seems at first. He loves Ava, and once his stage magician cousin, played by Jeremy Renner, gets a look at her, he's a goner as well. Gray has likened The Immigrant to the bald-faced, unapologetic melodrama you'd find in a Puccini libretto or maybe in the best silent films of the period. Josh, tell me, do you buy that? Do you think that that's the kind of romanticism that Gray has successfully achieved here? Is it enough for you or is it too much?
Well, I certainly buy that it's a melodrama. I think it works in that sense. I don't know if it reaches the lofty sights of maybe those source materials or inspirations that Gray mentions. It has the looks for sure. I'll give it that. I mean, this looks like an important burnished picture and one ready for accolades. I don't know if what the movie offers us beyond its images is quite as strong, to be honest with you. And even those images themselves, I mean, the period setting here, they really concentrate Gray and his cinematographer, the great Darius Kanji, really concentrate on grainy gray streets, smoky rooms. Every room seems to have a little bit of a haze in it. Soft glowing table lamps. I mean, there's a haze of history on this picture for sure. And you almost get the sense that the oil from an oil lamp was rubbed on the camera lens. Mm. I mean, you're so aware of this look. And though it is striking and well done, and I certainly appreciate that sort of attention to craft, I felt like it fossilized this story quite a bit, actually. There's an emphasis on the old-timey aesthetic that's so overwrought, and the color scheme kind of reminded me of this too, those fossils that are in prehistoric amber, you know what I mean, where they're kind of frozen in motion, and they have this this orange glow around them. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the same aesthetic here. And for me, it made the story a little inert.
Yeah, you're not alone. That's certainly, this picture's got a very bewildering range of reactions to it, I think. And I'm all over the place on James Gray as a filmmaker. I found a lot of his work, as you say, sort of dramatically just a bit stilted. And a lot of people who respond to it really find the work kind of clean, kind of classically four square, completely earnest, sincere, on point, wonderful with actors. There's a lot of things people point to Gray as strengths. But here, I like this film a good deal, largely because of the look of it. And yet it does have a narrative motor that's a very low hum. You know, it's not a big, I don't think it's actually accurately described as a melodrama, because I think people, if you hear that word, you go in expecting bigger things than you're going to get from The Immigrant. It's actually a very quiet picture.
That's fair. And, yeah.
It's a very quiet picture.
And the plot is melodrama, but the actions are maybe not.
Maybe not. And I mean, if I had one frustration with it the second time I saw it, a year after the first time I saw it at the Cannes Film Festival, I think the guys in it, Joaquin Phoenix and Jeremy Renner, are, I'm not sure they're entirely accurately cast. You need both parts in different ways, need a bigger kind of dose of theatrical brio than those two actors really have in their bones. I mean, the cheap ethnographic way to solve this, Josh, is just they should have hired a couple of British actors who could do American accents, you know, because it needs kind of, these guys are kind of the theater, of this, you know, of the turn of the century New York theater. And they're both, you know, Phoenix is a wonderful performer. He's worked in, I think, every one of Gray's films, essentially, up till now. And, but he doesn't have that quality. He's got something else. He's got this sort of tortured, anguished, morally conflicted quality, which is very good for this part. But, you know, Cotillard, on the other hand, wonderful face for the camera. I mean, and that sounds reductive and almost patronizing just to say someone's got a wonderful face for the camera, but I think Cotillard's a real actress as
it's
well.
It's a period face,
and,
too,
she looks terrific
in
1921. And yet I think the writing's a little weak there, too, in that character is everything happens to her and she's not driving the action. She's simply the victim of the action. Mm. And that's, yeah, it's kind of old school melodramatic plotting in that way. But all those negatives are kind of caveats aside, Josh. I did find on a very modest budget, I found this film really atmospherically magical. I think mostly it's all kind of old school practical design elements. There's a little bit of digital work going on in terms of how big a background on the Lower East Side tenements you're going to get, but it's not much. It's very sparing, and I mean, honestly, Josh, for the last shot alone, which is kind of the most, it's the best single thing James Gray has ever done as a director. There's an image where it's simply, I don't want to go into too much detail, but it's just simply a bifurcated image of two different futures, two different fates, two different characters taking the same different parts of the same shot in the last shot of the picture, and that's really magical. That's like Godfather 2 level good, and the rest of the picture isn't quite that good. But I still think it's a strange little kind of mirage of a film. I like it.
I do want to get to that last shot, but first let's go back to Cotillard, because to confuse things a bit, you're higher on the movie than I am, yet that's an element, one of the few elements I thought worked, was her performance, for pretty much the opposite reason that you did. I actually appreciated how this film seemed to give Ava some agency in her story. Mm. And the phrase you used earlier when you said she falls into prostitution, that is in a way what happens, but actually it's a choice she makes, a very active choice. Now, what the movie does nicely is also place that within history and within a socioeconomic background where her choices are way limited compared to the men. And it makes that reality clear. So right. It's not that it's the same sort of choice a man might be able to make, but she is a character who I think takes a lot of control over her story. And that actually made it interesting to me. So that narrative thread is there, but also it's in Cotillard's performance. Ava is not a victim in the traditional damsel in distress sense that you might expect from a period melodrama of that time. So the movie does look like that, but in the character of Ava, it doesn't quite work that way. She's fearful, for sure, but there also seems to be a scheming in her eyes a lot of times. And I like the detail when she first comes to this apartment Bruno brings her to. Not quite clear if it's hers. There's another woman there, a child, and he offers her a cot to sleep on. The first thing she does when he looks away is grab a knife laying on a table and slides
right,
under the pillow.
I think it's like an ice pick or something.
A coal pick. You're right. And I just like that because it shows that she's not naive. Mm. She is afraid, but she's not too afraid to just flee out the door. In other words, she's starting to weigh her options here. She's a schemer. She's a survivor. So I liked that, and I thought Cotillard played it well.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. I think the film doesn't have – we've both seen – the one thing we can agree on, I think, is that you can call it a melodrama, but the film doesn't have that kind of big clanking machinery of kind of mustache twirling melodrama, even though there's certainly a lot of morally repugnant behavior going on, but at heart it's about whether or not a guy like the Joaquin Phoenix character is redeemable, and this is what the Marion Cotillard character helps him find out, and that's a very kind of borderline hokey prospect or an idea to run a movie, but that's what's at the heart of Gray's film. He's made period pictures before, but never this far back. And there's some of the films he's made, like We Own the Night, the cops and gangsters film set, I believe, I forget if it was the 70s or the 80s. But, you know, that was a completely artificial, hoked up, I thought, fraudulent, good try of a crime movie. And there's something about Gray's style, when you put it further back in this more antiquated time, it works, it fits, and it doesn't, for me, it doesn't fossilize. It actually just kind of finds its natural element. And that, I think this is probably, you know, one of his, you know, probably his best film, or maybe just right after his best work. A lot of people love Two Lovers, which is a film I have to revisit. I know Matt Singer's crazy about it. I need another look at that one, because I think if you see a James Gray film, as I've seen at the Cannes Film Festival over the years, he's a huge favorite at Cannes. If you see it on less than a full night's sleep, you're going to be kind of fighting the rhythm of the movie all night. Mm-hmm. And seeing The Immigrant a second time is really seeing it like seeing it the first time, in that it's not a film that does tons of work for you. You have to kind of fall into it a little bit. And I did, even with its problems and limitations, Josh, I did find myself falling into The Immigrant a second time.
The levitation, perhaps the most miraculous feat you'll ever witness. Even the great Houdini himself has never defied gravity in such a manner. But tonight, I will attempt to rise before your very eyes. Now, there are those that query the possibility. And I understand that, you know. I've heard it all before. But I have to ask those people, how is it that you found yourself here, at this very moment, in America?
By boat, most likely, yes. It would be a long swim. But isn't it also because you believed it could happen?
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I believe.
You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson, here with the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips, and we are reviewing James Gray's The Immigrant. I would agree that We Own the Night has its problems, and a stuffiness certainly is one of them in terms of the drama. I think it does carry over, though, similarly to The Immigrant. I also would agree with you that the male lead performances here don't work at all. And it's curious about Phoenix because I've liked him even in We Own the Night. I think he has a good vibe with Gray in these also scheming and morally suspicious, conniving characters, which I think Phoenix can play well and certainly has done that for Gray. But here, wow, he just seems to – sometimes Phoenix can revert to a sleepy mode, and it seems like his energy level just drops in a film. And I don't know what to attribute that to, whether it's a connection with the material where it's just not firing him in the same way. And it is curious to see how a director that has been able to fire him doesn't this time around, at least for me.
Well, here's my issue with the guy. Okay, I think and what I was saying before, my real point with those two actors about the theatrical brio that might be missing, neither of those guys, as talented as Renner and Phoenix are, and Her was my favorite film last year, the Spike Jonze film starring Phoenix. I mean, Jeremy Renner's done amazing work and all kinds of stuff, you know, especially The Hurt Locker. Neither actor is particularly verbally adroit. They don't have that kind of technical facility, at least under Gray's direction. And it's a pretty... I wouldn't call it a Gabby script, but it's a verbally driven. You know, there's a lot of kind of verbal embroidery in The Immigrant that it's trying to capture a kind of period language and a sort of a different rhythm to the speech, and it lets people go on a bit. And I don't think either actor really knows how to necessarily energize that stuff. Now, speaking in both Polish and Polish accented English, Cotillard is actually the one who's kind of got the instincts, I think, for that. And yet she's playing the most passive part of the three. So, you know, this film is full of contradictions that way. But for the reasons you mentioned, Josh, I think, I mean, just I think those interiors are so exquisitely lit. And the fact that you're kind of in those apartments and some of those same, you know, backstage at this dumpy little sort of vaudeville house theater on the Lower East Side, you know, you really get to know what those designers could do on the budget they had. And I find the work that works so eloquent that it made up for the lack of eloquence of the acting.
Don't you get to know it too much? I mean, some of those scenes seem to drag on and on as if the filmmakers couldn't pull themselves away from the mise-en-scene that they had created. They were so pleased with it. It felt like that we're just going to sit here and let you look at these lamps a little longer because they're so beautiful.
Well,
Who cares if the scene has emotionally ended, or the actors aren't really pulling off the scene.
But I wouldn't characterize it like you're making it sound like Michael Cimino's worst scenes in Heaven's Gate, you know, where they really never ended, you know, where you're just, and you're also talking about zillions of dollars of extras and all that. This is a much smaller film. It's really closer to the theater than the movies, I think, in its scale. But, I guess, like, if you look at this in relation to a film like, say, Joan Micklyn Silver's Hester Street, which was, you know, even a lower budget picture a generation back, I really cherish, even if they're small and a little bit, or maybe in your case, you know, from your point of view, a lot flawed, I find that sort of work when you're trying to recreate early 20th century, maybe New York stories, happen to be another immigrant story too, of course, Hester Street, there's something that feels very true. It's very close to the street. It's very kind of, you know, close to the ground. It's not even, the stories aren't even necessarily accomplishing a great deal, and maybe from your perspective, not very artfully. But I find when you're working with that little money, you are, the audience and the artist both are kind of forced to focus on other things. And I didn't just sort of look at the scenery, but I think it's a very evocatively designed picture. And even with some of the miscasting issues, I found this one lingers in the mind. I mean, maybe it's sort of floated out of yours, but
No. I wouldn't say, you know, I took it that lightly, but it didn't stick with me as I had hoped, certainly with all the praise going in. I think, to go back to your point about the language, I think that does especially trip runner-up, particularly. And there's something about him. He's the one who seemed miscast here. Phoenix seemed, you know, capable of what the role wanted or what the role needed him to do. But Renner, I just never bought as this magician.
Dashing stage magician.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's exactly the British thing you talk about, the theatricality. It's just not a part of his physical nature.
Right. If he could just clone like two middle-aged Kevin Kleins. You know, if you really want to use an American, you know,
that's what you needed. Yeah, that might have worked a little bit better. So Renner just seemed to be working against the part the whole time. And Phoenix, again, to go back to the energy level, it's almost as if that final scene you talked about where, and we'll get to that shot as well, but before the shot, that final scene with him, Phoenix pops to life, and it's like he's going to make up for his lack of energy in the whole rest of the film. There you get some melodrama in that sequence between Ava and Bruno. There are confessions sort of shared and proclamations made.
Well, the clock's ticking. They have to
The clock is ticking.
It's life and death.
And Phoenix is just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And maybe because he was so, to my mind, played down earlier, there was such a discrepancy in the performance that scene really did not work. And I know it was meant to be, even before we get that shot, this is our showcase moment. It's staged that way, the dialogue speaks that way, and Phoenix just does not pull that scene off, certainly against Cotillard, because I think she does make that scene work.
You look at James Gray's career, it's a fascinating one, because it's in economic terms it shouldn't exist. His first film, The Yards, cost something like $15-16 million. It made not even $1 million. I mean, the same thing is essentially happening with The Immigrant. It's not even finding an audience in Europe, where in somewhat better circumstances, Cotillard's marquee value would have guaranteed a better return at the box office. Now, you know, I'm not much of a box office analyst, but the film, you know, is a quiet film without much of a narrative motor. It was always going to need it was a film you would have needed to really seek out and find to see what you think of it, because it's here today, gone tomorrow, in the kind of exhibition climate we have. But he's not an exciting filmmaker. James Gray would never say of himself, "I am an exciting filmmaker." He's just his interests are elsewhere. He's not flashy, certainly, and not that you require flash all the time, but I'm frankly still struggling a little bit with why I resist some of his work and I find myself seduced by his better pictures. But I think there's something about the period trappings of this one, Josh, that for me fit his particular kind of four square old school style. And I mean, it's small, but for me, kind of piquant. It's piquant.
Yeah, you say he's not a flashy filmmaker, no. But that final shot. I mean, that
is great, but it's very quiet, though. It's very quiet.
Heavy-handed
for you, allegorically?
It's not heavy-handed.
I don't want to give it away.
No, we shouldn't give it away, but I think I can talk about...
It's a sled. Okay, it's Rosebud, nice. And it's a sled.
They go into a closet in Ellis Island, and there they find a sled.
Says Rosebud. Okay.
I do think it's emblematic, though, of my primary problem with the film. The shot is so flashy that people were referring to it. I first heard about it on Twitter accidentally before I had even seen the film. I wish I hadn't. They didn't give anything away either. But just the fact that I knew, now I have to look out for this shot. Maybe that tripped me up a little bit, because I found it to be ostentatious it's masterfully framed and composed. So this is another instance where I'm admiring the craft, but more questioning the employment of it or the volume of the craft. Maybe that's a better way to put it. Because I think
you got Twittered on this one.
You know what happened? As I'm watching it, I'm thinking, oh, okay, I see that in that half of the frame. Oh, look what's happening here. And then I saw how the motion proceeded. And my thoughts drifted further and further away from what it meant for the story, and more into how did they do that?
Yeah.
Wow, look at that's in focus, and they have that. This is pretty amazing. I wonder how they got the lighting to work there. Before I knew it, and maybe, again, I wasn't that involved in the story to this point anyways, though I was in that final scene a little bit more.
Right.
I was taken out of the narrative because of the masterful craft. It's an odd position to be in, but that's where I was left at end of the film.
I experienced it a little differently. I think it's actually saying a very simple thing. It's just basically kind of saying goodbye to two different characters, and I don't want to give it away, but, you know, in two different fates, in two different directions. And there's a visual trick involved a little bit. I'm not even sure how they pulled that off necessarily, but it's not so kind of like, wow, how'd they do that? That was not my experience of it. Mine was, it's a much more kind of plaintive and melancholy farewell. It's like a dying fall moment. It's not really a da-da-da-da-da-da ending, you know. I don't know. I find this just, it's an immigration story, Josh, in the most kind of obvious ways. I mean, from the title on down, although it was originally titled The Nightingale, I think. It's not like he always had this, which is an old Chaplin title, right? The Charlie Chaplin 1916 short, one of his greats, The Immigrant. It's an immigrant story that it does have one foot in kind of stage melodrama or operatic librettos of the day and one foot in a quieter, more kind of neorealistic thing, you know. And I think of all his films, I find this one to be, it's got Gray's kind of most assured craft in it. Problems, limitations, I may always have them with James Gray, but I had fewer of them with this one.
Well, The Immigrant, a rare differing of opinion for us, Michael, at least lately.
Well, it's not a difference of opinion. It's just more of a right and wrong thing.
I know you like to frame it that way. That's okay. Probably, what, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Marx Brothers is the last time we disagreed this strongly? Gotta go back a little bit.
There's the world's worst film festival evening right there. What, like three Marx Brothers films, followed by Raiders of the Lost Ark, followed by James Gray's
The Immigrant. Well, that would be a long night for me. The Immigrant is currently out in limited release. If you have seen it or are going to see it, let us know if you agree or disagree with either mine or Michael's take. Email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail. We've had a few of those lately and certainly appreciate them. You can leave that voicemail at 312-264-0744. Of course, you can find us on Twitter at filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting. It's Film Spotting poll time when we come back. Listeners weigh in on their relationship with the novel, The Fault in Our Stars. Then we'll force you to define exactly how you feel about the movie phenomenon that is Channing Tatum. Statistical answers to life's biggest questions. That's what the Film Spotting poll is for. Stay with us.
It's the time and the place. Every line on your face. It's the truth. And the lie is to live and to die. Oh, what a beautiful world. It's a girl and a boy and the first taste of joy. It's an old photograph of two hearts torn in half. Oh, what a beautiful world.
Jumping in here for just a minute, folks, to remind you that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. At Shutterstock.com, you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project. I did spend some time on Shutterstock today searching through their archives, what was available in terms of videos. Thought I would use, as we usually do, a few topics tied to the reviews for this week's show. So I looked up immigration, tied to James Gray's The Immigrant. 1,905 videos were available, some of them as gorgeous as the work in James Gray's film. Also looked up dragons and found even more. 3,665 videos. Some of those were of real-life Komodo dragons, which are way more terrifying than those in How to Train Your Dragon 2 because they're real. They could come and get you. Now, whether you need videos for your website, your advertisement, your multimedia presentation, or any other type of film project, you can choose from over a million high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations, and 3D motion graphics. The clips come in a variety of digital formats. Most do come in HD, high definition, and now 4K. Shutterstock sources video clips from around the world and puts them at your fingertips. Many contributors to Shutterstock are professional filmmakers. Shutterstock gives you the assets you need to bring your creative projects to the next level, and they make it easy. They have sophisticated tools so you can search and drill down by category, clip, resolution, contributor name, and more. You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just start an account and begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next creative project could be like. Save video selections that you find to your clip box. Then, once you decide to purchase, use offer code 614, and new accounts will receive 20% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 20% off footage clips on new accounts, use offer code FILM614. We thank Shutterstock for their support.
It's a walk in the park, or a shot in the dark. It's the thief in the night.
Same identities, same assignment.
We're going back to high school?
You look like you're about 50. You're going to MC State. Somebody's out there, they're cooking up a new drug. It's Adderall mixed with ecstasy, mixed with God knows what else.
It's wipey?
Wi-Fi stands for work hard, yes, play hard, yes.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Michael Phillips. I'm Josh Larson. Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill, along with Ice Cube, are back in theaters this weekend with the ingeniously titled 22 Jump Street. Our poll question this week has us attempting to plumb the mystery of Channing Tatum's popularity. It can't be just his good looks, or could it, Michael? That's in a bit. But a few notes first. Back in January, we mentioned listener Matt Reynolds' documentary comedy, The Great Chicken Wing Hunt. It's about, quote, a band of spicy food buffs and their quest to find the world's best chicken wing. Well, Matt's doc is going to make its Chicago debut in a couple of weeks at the Gene Siskel Film Center. That's going to be Saturday, June 21st. And get this, your movie ticket includes some wings. I like this trend. I'm thinking The Immigrant, maybe porridge. Would they serve porridge? I don't know what. If you had to pair some sort of snack food.
You're thinking of a Bruinview format for almost every film.
Every film.
I like it.
It's the future.
I would do the buffalo wing as a separate, messier part of the audience.
Yeah.
You know, like the really hot and the greasy stuff. Yeah.
Yes. It sounds good. I'll take some wings with my movie. We are going to have more information about Matt's film in the show notes. Congratulations, Matt. We have a correction also we want to get to. It has to do with our recent Massacre Theater winners. Those of you paying very, very close attention, I would not have been one of these people, might have thought that Patrick Madigan of Chicago managed to win Massacre Theater twice in a row. Not only is that impossible, it's also not true. It was our mistake, of course, for failing to choose a new winner. Probably something faulty with the film spotting hat. I don't know. We're sending it to the repair shop. We'll see how it comes back.
You need a new haberdasher.
A new haberdasher. And those are all over the place. Shouldn't be hard at all. The actual winner of our Cape Fear Massacre Theater, Nicholas Barner from New London, Connecticut. Congratulations, Nicholas. Email feedback@filmspotting.net to claim your Film Spotting t-shirt. And Patrick, if you got two t-shirts, please return one of them. Adam's stockpile is a little low. We could use that back. All right, we have some free passes we want to give away. Always like it when we get a chance to do this. The first is for We Are the Best. This is the latest from Sweden's Lukas Moodysson. It's been ecstatically reviewed so far. It was also Adam's number three most anticipated movie of the summer. It's coming to Chicago on June 27, but we have some free passes to a screening on Monday, June 23. That's going to be at the Landmark Century Center Theater. Also, passes for the theatrical run to a film I just saw today, can't wait to review, coming up on the show. It's The Rover. This is David Michaud's thriller set about 10, 15 years in the future in the Australian outback. Really interesting film. He also directed Animal Kingdom, which is a favorite here on Film Spotting. That opens here in Chicago on June 20. Again, we will have some free passes for the theatrical run to that. You can find more information and enter the contest for those films at filmspotting.net. Final note here has to do with Film Spotting 500. Coming up live, we'll be live at Chicago's beautiful Music Box Theater Saturday night, July 26th. So just a little bit over a month away. Special guests include you, Mr. Michael Phillips.
Thank you. I'm going to dress up.
You are.
Spiffy.
I'm glad you told me that.
Yep.
I'll have to go beyond the shorts and the t-shirt
Spiffo.
Then this time.
I don't care if it's radio or podcasting. Well, I don't
they'll
care.
They'll see us, so you
There's
should dress
there.
Up.
There's people there.
Looking forward to that. We have other special guests. Not that you're not special enough for a whole show, Michael, but we're going to add, I know you appreciate the work and the criticism of Dana Stevens from Slate.
Great, one of my favorites.
Excellent critic. She will be there to join us. She was there for a show we did, I want to say, last summer or the summer before.
Lincoln Hall. That was fun.
It was a lot of fun to have her there. She's always great. So Dana Stevens will be joining us. And also another special guest. This is director Rian Johnson, filmmaker behind Brick, filmmaker behind Looper. Huge fan of Film Spotting. He was actually listening to Film Spotting before I was.
Wow.
So he's been a huge supporter of the show.
Looper was a big financial success. Why the hell would he drop whatever he's supposed to be doing to come to the Music Box?
Well, don't say that because it's too true. I mean, this is a busy guy. So he has told us that he should be able to make it, and we're looking forward to that. But you're right. I mean—
Okay, but if he backs out— He's not, he's certainly a well-established director. His face is not well-known. We could put any guy in there and call him Rian Johnson.
You've just given away our backup plan.
We're good. Mum's the word.
We've got it covered either way, but that is the plan for now. Dana Stevens, Michael Phillips, Rian Johnson, Adam and I will be there too. Join us Saturday night, July 26th, Film Spotting 500 Live at Chicago's Music Box Theater. Information and a link to how you can buy your tickets is at filmspotting.net.
What's your name?
Hazel.
And what's your full name?
Hazel Grace Lancaster. Why are you looking at me like that?
Because you're beautiful.
Oh my God.
Let's go watch a movie.
What?
Hmm?
Huh? I'm free later this week.
No, I mean now.
You could be an axe murderer.
There's always that possibility.
That's Shailene Woodley and Ansel Elgort in a scene from this weekend's box office champ, The Fault in Our Stars. The YA novel adaptation beat out Tom Cruise and Edge of Tomorrow in millions of dollars earned and, we assume, a number of tears shed by audience members. Fault, in the words of the New York Times critic A.O. Scott, is an expertly built machine for the mass production of tears. Tony wasn't so high in the film, Michael, and neither were you. Maybe you can share a few thoughts on the film in a bit. First, though, I want to get to our poll results regarding Fault in Our Stars. Last time, we asked you not about the film, but about the best-selling novel by John Green. We wanted to know your reaction to it, so we gave you these options. The novel, The Fault in Our Stars, I read it and loved it. I read it and, meh, my kid read it. I've heard of it. What's a book? Michael, what were the results of this poll?
All right, fifth place, my kid read it, 4%. Okay, so that's 4% people have kids who read this. I read it and meh, 7%. I read it and loved it, 15%. What's a book, 20%. What a bunch of wags here writing in, don't even know what a book is. Stupid listenership.
Oh,
and,
boy.
And I've heard of it, 53%, an honest majority. I've heard of it.
An honest majority,
But not the target audience, apparently.
No, it doesn't sound like it. We did hear from Keith Hook Up the Doll Moser, that's his nickname there, from Albertus, Pennsylvania. Keith said, picked this up last summer, shortly after hearing Berbiggs was cast in the film adaptation. Keith's obviously a close personal friend of actor and comedian Mike Birbiglia. Read it in 3 days, Keith said, on a cruise, and caught myself crying on the Lido deck. John Green is a great writer, and I'm excited to see how the film adaptation works.
And clearly it does work for a lot of people. Julia Wilson from Georgia says, on the other hand, I vote meh. I read The Fault in Our Stars right after it came out, being a fan of John Green, the YouTuber. Is that true?
Yeah, he's got a popular YouTube channel.
Being a fan of John Green, the YouTuber, I was also ready to be a fan of John Green, the writer, and he is a good writer, but I could feel his fingerprint on every page and sentence of this book. It's narrated by a teenage girl, and every line of it feels like it was written by a 30-year-old man, because it was. As a 20-year-old, I was a teenager not too long ago. Hazel and Augustus seem less like real people and more like Green's projections of what he thinks teenagers are actually like. I know I'm in the great minority when I say this, but The Fault in Our Stars is not without fault.
All right. Well, speaking of fault, we did have a couple listeners who objected to our wording of the question. That's something we've been getting a lot of recently. They specifically didn't like the implication that if you hadn't heard of Fault in Our Stars, it could only mean that you don't read at all. We heard this from James Carolus. I don't like this poll question. If you haven't heard of Fault in Our Stars, you don't know what a book is? I've read two novels by Thomas Pynchon. I think I know what a book is, even though I haven't read some YA novel. Badly worded poll question, in my opinion.
Hmm.
I think I'm going to read two novels by Thomas Pynchon, just so I can say that, so I can throw that out there randomly. I've read two novels by Thomas
Pynchon.
Honestly,
if you've read a couple, you deserve the harumph. You know? You've earned it.
A harumph from Michael.
That's right.
We also heard from Patricia in Portland, Oregon.
And she says, movies and books are my favorite things, but in a death match, books win every time. I can read them in bits. They are like watching the movie and getting all the DVD extras. And most importantly, a lot of them have fully developed female characters and plots, something that is lacking in the film landscape of today. Amen to that, I say. I'll be interested to see if the movie adaptation of The Fault in Our Stars keeps Hazel Grace front and center as the book does, or if it performs the standard movie jujitsu of shoving the girl to the side in favor of the male's story, which it did not do. I will say that. It did not do that.
Yeah, I want to hear your opinion on Fault in Our Stars. I haven't seen it yet, though I do want to, but I know you have. So what did you make of it?
First of all, admission that this happens with about, unfortunately, 10 to 20% of the films I review that are based on literary properties. I did not read the original in this case, so I went in from that perspective. And I think I acknowledged it plainly. Up front, I'm not saying how faithful this was to the original, whatever. But my understanding is, and from the chapters I have read, and there was one scene in particular I wanted to kind of suss out. It's kind of the most egregious scene in the film, which is the momentous first kiss between these two cancer patients at the Anne Frank Museum in Amsterdam, where you're sort of, right or wrong, you're kind of hauling in a massive load of tragic memories from the Holocaust and kind of equating it with the suffering and also the stubborn, clinging to life of these two. Okay, that felt all wrong and icky to me, the way it was handled in the film. And I just wanted to see if it had, how close it
So you went back to the book.
To the book,
after
and it's very, very, very faithful in that regard. So,
but maybe that wasn't a good decision, you're saying. Did you find the film overall to be a little heavy-handed that
quite
way?
Quite faithful, I think. I think, honestly, it's not bad. I don't begrudge. I kind of like the fact that it's a huge success and that it's upended everybody's expectations about how it's going to perform with, just in terms of money. And the thing that does kind of make me nuts, Josh, is that every time you get a film that is essentially a female-driven story that becomes a big success, you get this weird tsunami of kind of, I never knew that, female audiences could actually turn up. Whether it's a kind of a
The Heat last year, I believe it was, or Devil Wears Prada. Yeah,
exactly.
There's always one or two every summer. Everyone acts so surprised.
And all the properties are completely different, and yet it just all serves to remind you that, why the hell are we getting more, projects that actually, either come from a female screenwriter or, tell a story that isn't just about two mismatched male buddy cops or whatever. And, Shailene Woodley's a steadily developing really good actress. She's consistently better than most of the material that she's dealing with. I think this material is essentially artful schlock, and so fans of the book can kill me now. But the film I think is okay for what it is. And I think Woodley is much better than that. I don't think her co-star, who's kind of a crucial part of this film, Ansel Elgort, is really, halfway to her abilities right now. So
okay.
I always found, the whole movie depends on those two. And I always found, and the characters also, there's an interesting debate, I think, online and in Twitter and the rest of it, about whether or not that character, Gus, is, a charming, charismatic sort of dreamboat, or is he somewhat of a stalker, kind of somewhat of a smug, creepy, whatever. What kind of guy is he? Does that make him a dimensional character, or just simply one where it's so kind of open-ended and sketchy in the writing, you can read in what you want into this idealized male co-star, right? I just find him kind of a weak actor at this point. He may well get there in 5 years, but Shailene Woodley, on the other hand, was good right away. I mean, she was. You look 5 years ago at her work in The Descendants,
sure.
playing one of the least immediately likable teenage girls in recent movies, and then you follow that with a couple of years later, The Spectacular Now, and she's tremendously moving in in one of the most, you know, pure-hearted, sweet-natured female teenagers you've ever seen in a movie lately. And so she's got range, and she's, you know, playing a kind of a little of both in this. And she can take a movie anywhere, frankly. But, you know, the movie's okay.
Well, I'm still eager to see it. She is a big reason, but hopefully I'll get to weigh in on that sometime in the near future here. Right now, we're going to move on to this week's poll, which does involve more demographic research. We've been doing some of this social research lately with our film spotting poll questions. With 22 Jump Street opening this weekend, we're curious about you and your relationship to Channing Tatum. Not specifically you, Michael, listeners as well, though we'll get you to weigh in on this poll question. We're asking Channing Tatum, I've got a man crush, woman crush, no crush, no crush, but I think he's a fine actor. I'm currently dating Channing Tatum. Or is this where I admit to my Jonah Hill crush? So a variety of options there. I don't know if we've covered every way you could respond to Channing Tatum. We tried to cover as many as possible. At least give listeners a variety of options of these, Michael. What's your gut reaction? I know this is something that keeps you up at night. How exactly do I feel about Channing Tatum? And I also know, I'm going to preface this, give you a little more time to think about it. I also know you're not a fan necessarily of his acting skills. I believe it was Magic Mike we reviewed, the three of us, on Film Spotting.
Yeah.
And you weren't as high on his performance there.
Although
in general.
I like that film. I like that film a great deal. Yeah. But I reject every one of these choices, Josh, because, you know, that's just the kind of guy I am. But I think, honestly, the review I wrote on 22 Jump Street, which I enjoyed, not quite as much as the first one, but it begins with an apology to the actor, because I thought he was, my initial impression was misjudged. I thought he was down in the kind of the Taylor Lautner, this is a few years ago, the Taylor Lautner level of lousy. But originally it was a decision made, you know, too early on in a guy's career. And now when you see that he's actually sought out and worked with directors like Steven Soderbergh, and, you know, lucky enough to be in the Bennett Miller film Foxcatcher, which is coming out later this year. You can say what you want, but the guy is trying to not necessarily expand his range, but try to just figure out how to kind of
the right place for it.
How to be on camera, you know, and figure out a way to kind of start hitting two notes at once emotionally, which he hasn't really, you know, come to yet. But I mean, he came at it from, you know, where he came at it. He's a dancer primarily, and he's learning to be an actor. And yeah, he's getting there.
So can I put you down then for no crush, but I think he's a fine actor? It sounds like that's what you said.
Fine-ish.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll write fine-ish here for you. I'm also going to take your 22 Jump Street as an apology to me, because I have been a longtime supporter of Channing Tatum. Mm. Right from Step Up. I thought he was great in Step Up. My vote here would go man crush, dance crush, probably. I mean, I just, in Magic Mike too. I mean, that is part of acting. And he's found a few properties where it employs those skills very well for the film that he's in.
He's got the moves like Tatum. He's got the moves like Tatum.
That is true. Do I see this guy ever becoming some multifaceted multiple Oscar winner? No, but I think, as you were saying, with the right property, his skills can be showcased in a really strong way. And I'd also agree, the sense of humor that's being developed in these Jump Street films is fun to see as well. All right. How about listeners, though? We'll see if they have the courage to actually choose one of the options we gave. Michael, you can vote now at filmspotting.net. As always, leave your comments. We do like to hear what you think of the polls, even if they're criticisms of how we worded them.
What I am about to tell you sounds crazy, but you have to listen to me. Your very lives depend on it.
This does not be bad.
You see, this isn't the first time.
The trailer there for Edge of Tomorrow with Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt. The director is Doug Liman. And this is a sci-fi variation on Groundhog Day in a way. It's set in the future on Earth, where an alien invasion has been underway. So the Earth has been uniting this globalized military, trying to repel the aliens, largely set in Europe is where the action takes place. And Tom Cruise is a soldier who finds, for various reasons, all of a sudden his days start resetting. Similar to Groundhog Day, he wakes up after he's killed in battle and finds that he's 24 hours earlier about before he's sent into battle. And the movie proceeds him learning from his experiences how to get a little further in that day and so on. I really like this film. I think it's one of the better summer blockbusters. And one of the primary reasons for me is the way it plays with the Tom Cruise persona. Mm-hmm. It starts out with his character, Major William Cage. He's sort of the PR guy for this global defense force.
And he's a chicken. He's a chicken.
Oh, chicken or weasel. Weasel is the word that came to my mind, because he actually tries to get out of this assignment. The military has planned this assault on the beaches of Normandy to try to put out this alien force once and for all, and they want him to go there. He, instead of recruiting people safely, they want him to be there, get filmed in the action. And he says no. I think one of the great lines is something like, I do this so I don't have to do that.
Right.
And he even tries to blackmail his superior to get out of it. And so, again, as he goes through these days, he has to learn how to become a real soldier. It was great seeing Tom Cruise play a weasel. I mean, I think, you know, he puts his charisma to different use there.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of fun. And for a while, this was a deconstruction of the Cruise action hero savior.
Right.
I think it worked really well. I think Emily Blunt is very good in it. The action by Lyman is quite well, including the variations of this assault on the beaches of Normandy. Yet, by the end of this movie, what it essentially does is reconstruct Tom Cruise, right? And until he becomes what he's always been, Tom Cruise.
Unstoppable
killing machine. You know, I kind of just wanted to reset the movie by the ending myself. Where did you fall on
it? I like the film. Roughly where you did on this one, Josh. I thought it was a diverting picture. And I think Doug Liman is a pretty good director. He's not my favorite action director in terms of the way he shoots the battle scenes. It's a certain style that you have to kind of live with or not, which is a lot of very kind of close-up, handheld, faux documentary stuff. And then there's an insane amount of green screen action going on behind it, because you have these enormous spinning metallic, you know, like squid-like alien beings that move very quickly and kill quick. But the premise is something about this kind of repeated action premise, Josh, that is inherently funny. And they do play it for some laughs in that Cruise and Emily Blunt are just getting kind of smarter and smarter about anticipating where they don't want to die the next time they try this. And I mean, Tom Cruise dies constantly in this movie, but it's in a kind of a peppy summer blockbuster way. He's always back for more, and that's also part of the Cruise persona, that he just keeps, you know, he gets knocked down, he gets back up. And
yeah, high energy,
run, right? Yeah, and yet there was a business story coming out of the LA Times recently about why the biggest budgeted summer blockbusters we've seen in the last month or two. You're talking about, you know, the Spider-Man picture. You're talking about the latest X-Men, the Godzilla reboot. You're talking about Edge of Tomorrow. Why are they opening pretty well and then fading fast? Is it just that there's so much stuff in the distribution sort of pipeline right now? Are people just kind of losing focus after 1 week, and there's no kind of got to see it? A lot of it with Edge of Tomorrow, I think, Josh, is that you have a movie that is already kind of repeating its own action. Kids the ages between, like, say, 15 and 18, why would they see this film twice? I like this film, and I enjoyed it once, but near the end of it, and it doesn't have a great third act, I think.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Maybe it has to do with the ending, because if people's experiences has, like mine, is you go into this film and for the first half you're like, this is something really fresh, this is unique, and then the last 20 minutes or so are pretty much like any other sci-fi. The savior of the world has to reach this one centralized location, and so if people are going out of the film thinking, well, that was another familiar thing, they're not talking about it. If it had sustained that level of ingenuity that it had towards the beginning, maybe it would have turned into something more of a word of mouth hit. I don't know.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, that's kind of all Monday morning quarterbacking about why things, but I did enjoy it. I enjoy Godzilla a great deal too, although that's got almost all its attempts. The funny thing about Godzilla, I think, is all the attempts to make it full of dramatic human interest kind of fall flat. But you're just waiting for the next. But I love the degree to which you're using the critters in Godzilla. You know, they're not stomping all over the movie every second. You're really actually anticipating them.
Godzilla, another success to my mind this summer so far. A couple of bonus reviews we are giving you here on Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson with the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips. From Edge of Tomorrow, we move to How to Train Your Dragon 2, which, Michael, you just came out of the screening. You have some early reactions you can share with us.
I'll just give you a sentence or two. I mean, I enjoyed the first How to Train Your Dragon. I think the second one, which screened out of competition at the Cannes Film Festival, just to get, it was kind of where they did the international press junket, and it wasn't obviously one of the 24 competition titles, but I kept hearing amazing things, like people just loving it. And I thought, well, maybe they had a bad day at the Art House. And they, you know, it was a nice break from the Bulgarian picture or whatever. And you know what? It's a really, really good sequel, and it's got a certain heft and emotional punch to it that exceeds that of the original. Roger Deakins, the great cinematographer, again, back as the visual consultant. And it's just it's one of the best looking of all the DreamWorks animated features. It doesn't feel like it was written or directed or produced by committee. It's actually the work of a handful of really talented people who knew how to extend the story. Big fan. That's all I can say for now.
All right. Edge of Tomorrow and How to Train Your Dragon 2 both are in wide release right now. If you've seen them, let us know what you think. Feedback@filmspotting.net. Okay, Michael, I hope your papers are in order. When we come back, you'll need to present your favorite movies about immigration if you want to gain entry into Film Spotting Nation. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
We ran off chasing rainbows beneath the blue Montana sky, and we self-proclaimed our freedom with a roar. We crossed those raging rivers, and we drank the taverns dry, and we bowed our heads to legends gone before. Are you ready for the long journey home? The flatland swamps and bayous in your bones, the simple life tastes sweeter.
What's your name, little girl?
Ariel.
And who are you?
She's Christy.
And what age are you, Christy?
She's 10.
Welcome to America.
Thanks very much.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson. Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune is in for Adam this week. We get into this week's top five with that clip from In America, the 2002 film from director Jim Sheridan about a family of Irish immigrants making their way in 80s-era New York City. In America is one of the more surprising members of the Film Spotting pantheon, that group of films that Adam, myself, Sam Van Halgeren, we really appreciate to a level that they'd appear on a ton of top five lists if we were able to keep listing them, so we set them aside. I know Adam and a couple of the show's previous hosts were really high on In America. Luckily, when I joined the show, I happened to also appreciate it, so that worked out well. Also means I couldn't choose it for this list, however. Now, when Adam and I first talked about this list, top five movies about immigrants, we considered some criteria, like maybe limiting it to just films that take place in America, so immigrants to America. But then we did decide eventually to open it up so that it could concern immigration in all parts of the world. Did you have any sort of limitations or criteria in mind, Michael, as you put your titles together?
I'm glad you opened it up, because I think it's, you could certainly get a rich list of, just in terms of people coming to and dealing with this new world here in America. But this story is the whole story we're living now, I think, is that the paths of immigration and the kind of cross currents culturally, are especially in Europe, are just going in every direction at once. And all the lines are so blurred right now. And having lived in LA a few years, it was that city, especially of all the cities I've lived in, you really felt that immigration and the ways of immigration that that come through a certain neighborhood or a certain city, just define it and redefine it, and then redefine every aspect of this country, every not just every generation, but every day. And It's a great subject, and I don't know. I know so little about so many people that live in this city, Chicago, and I always look to learn more about what they're going through from the movies, because mm-hmm. it's an empathetic, you know, way of understanding what we all went through. Because I mean, nobody started here. You know, very few of us anyway.
Well, what were some of those stories about the immigrant experience that made your list? What's your number five?
My number five is a film that very few people, I think, know in this country. It's called Import Export. It's an Austrian filmmaker, Ulrich Seidel, from 2007, and it's it's just briefly, it's an astonishingly grungy film that follows a nurse from Ukraine who's moonlighting as a sex worker, and she heads to Austria to kind of start a new life there. Meantime, you have another story of an unemployed Vienna man and his stepfather who are journeying to another corner of the EU. And it's a painful film to watch. It's a lot of it's kind of horribly funny, but this question of all these different kind of dislocated souls looking for a home and just trying to find their way in this strange new kind of developing EU. And the film's in several languages, German, Russian, Slovak, and it's all a very bleak, but I think a pretty honest depiction of what a lot of modern Europe looks like. And, you know, it's also a story that you can find plenty of American parallels. I saw this at the Cannes Film Festival one year, a year where like every other film had some variation on this story of people just countries being, you know, newly remade by so many different ethnic factions and different stories, and it's all very uneasy and economically kind of tense, and options seem very limited in some ways, and yet expansive in others. So it's a bracing, tough little movie called Import Export.
Import Export. All right. I'm one of those people who was unfamiliar with it. Dislocated Souls, however, they do populate my number five as well. That pick is Stranger Than Paradise. This is Jim Jarmusch's second film from 1984. And it's something of an Inside Out immigration movie. So the dislocated souls, they're also the people who are already here. It does take the arrival of a foreigner to reveal that the people already living in America can be discombobulated, can feel out of place, can feel lost. John Lurie and Richard Edson play a pair of meandering friends in New York City. They're sort of like hipster forefathers, you could say. And they get a visit from Esther Bellenc Ava. This is a cousin from Hungary who needs a place to stay before she makes a permanent move to live with her aunt in Cleveland. She's something of a bemused presence in the film, observing American habits and culture, and her askance observations about life in the U.S. reveal to these two guys something that they've known deep down but probably haven't admitted, that they're not really making much out of this land of supposed opportunity. They're just kind of wasting around.
Where does that meat come from?
Really?
What does that meat come from?
I guess it comes from a cow.
From a cow? It doesn't even look like meat.
Ava, stop bugging me, will you? You know, this is where we eat in America. Mm-hmm. I got my meat. I got my potatoes. I got my vegetables. I got my dessert. And I don't even have to wash the dishes.
Now, in response to this realization, the three of them embark on an all-American road trip. So they go from New York to Cleveland to Florida in search of identity, in search of purpose. But of course, this being a minimalist Jarmusch movie, they don't really find any of that or necessarily find that. I've always liked Stranger Than Paradise, but I thought about it more explicitly in terms of this immigration theme and found that it certainly did give the movie a different layer. If you think about it in those terms, America, it's not only a nation of bootstrap gathering achievers. You know, that's what we think about in so many movies will chronicle, but it's also this nation of bored wanderers. And a lot of independent film does pick up on that. Certainly, Jarmusch's work does, I think, quite a bit. You even get a thread of that probably in Only Lovers Left Alive, his film from this year.
Oh, sure.
Which I like quite a bit.
Yes.
So,
I mean, Tangiers and Detroit seem equally exotic and equally sort of at odds with itself.
And out-of-place characters, right? So, so it's this idea of this detached sort of outsider cool that his films often had that does capture a bit of the immigrant experience, I think. So Stranger Than Paradise is my number five. How about your number four,
number
Michael?
Number four, this is maybe a looser definition of immigration, but it's really, but if you just want to open it up to cross-cultural issues, it's Terrence Malick's The New World. This is the story we know from childhood classroom exercises and reading. Captain John Smith, the English colonialist, and his relationship with the daughter of the tribal chieftain, the woman we know as Pocahontas, who, of course, has been subjected to her own Disney animated musical
subjected?
Feature.
Yes. Subjected? Is that yes. how you describe
yeah.
that?
Yeah, okay. She was, yeah. You know, this is, every Malick film is essentially an illustration or an exploration of the idea of going native. It goes from Badlands on. It's just simply, it's how do we get back to the land, and mm-hmm. how do we find our place? How does humankind even find its place with this? And there are moments in The New World where typically with Malick, the best stuff is free of its own voiceovers, which are rampant, and free of any kind of conventional dialogue or even conventional narrative, where you simply see scenes where you have the Native Americans peeking through the bushes, and you see these three amazing ships coming through, and then you have you have Wagner's Das Rheingold music playing in the background, and conversely later you have Pocahontas taken over to England, and she's sort of finding her way through these unbelievably well manicured English gardens, meeting English royalty and all that. These are conventional scenes and almost completely cliche in some way, but there's real magic in the way Malick sees how strangers in strange lands are having their eyes opened. We don't really get any kind of conventional psychological reading of the situation either. It's simply up to us to imagine how strange these cross currents and these cross cultural collisions really would be. And you know, a lot of his films are frustrating. It all depends on a lot of it depends on the mood at the time when you see it. The New World is exasperating one minute and really kind of wonderful the next. But yeah, it's always rolled around in my head. I like this film a lot.
I love that you picked The New World because it is a bit of an oddball choice for an immigration experience film, though I can see how it works. You made a good argument for it. What I don't love is that this is the only Terrence Malick film I don't like. And
the only one?
I think so.
To the Wonder is
well,
more
see, that's
effective.
That's exactly where I was going to go, because to me, this is his self-satirical Terrence Malick film. It's the Saturday Night Live Terrence Malick film that Terrence Malick directed. I mean, and that's the charge people lob against To the Wonder, right? They say, oh my, he's gone over the top this time. This is just enough.
Okay,
enough.
But that film too, you can actually make the same, kind of loose, this is a stranger in a strange land.
They're touching on the same themes, exactly right. And so whatever it is about The New World that I feel is cliched in that sense, I need to watch it again, because I know people who proclaim The New World as his masterpiece. A lot of people, actually. There's a strong thread of support that I've read, and I've heard people talk to me about it personally. I'm just not on that boat, but good pick for this list. I like how you worked it in here for an immigration experience movie. My number four is the film Goodbye Solo, and this is from writer-director Raman Barani, who's an American indie filmmaker who also made 2005's Man Push Cart. This was about a Pakistani street vendor selling coffee in Manhattan. Well, Goodbye Solo also centers on an immigrant, Solo of the title, played by Suleiman C. Savane. Solo is a Senegalese cab driver working in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and he picks up a depressed older man played by Red West who asks for a one-way trip to a local peak, and Solo begins to suspect that he may be planning to commit suicide. Now, Roger Ebert was one of Barani's biggest supporters. Barani actually made his fourth appearance at Ebert Fest just this past year. So I wanted to read from Ebert's 2009 review of Goodbye Solo. In that review, he declared Barani the new great American director. Here's what he said of the film. Barani's films are about outsiders in America. Here a Senegalese who wants to help an American whose weathered face belongs in a Western. Barani, whose parents immigrated from Iran, felt like an outsider when he was growing up in Winston-Salem. He loves the city, and you can tell that in his film. He is curious about people, and you can tell that from all of his films. He told me he asks the same question of all of his characters. How do you live in this world? So that's Ebert in his review. And I think Goodbye Solo does ask that question, how do you live in this world, within the context of two worlds. Actually, you have the question of how will Solo live in this new world for him of Winston-Salem, far from his home. And the movie's very rooted in that sort of context and detail. But it works on a larger scale, too. The question of how do any of us live in the world at large, especially, I think, in how we relate to each other. You see this in the growing relationship between the two men. So Goodbye Solo, my number
four. That's a good pick, Josh. I really love Barani's work, and especially Goodbye Solo and Chop Shop, I think, give you a great sense of, at different points along the economic scale, about what it really means in a daily life sense, what it means to be a newcomer to this country, and just sort of dealing with all sorts of things, prejudice and just day-to-day survival. And he does it in a way that is just completely humane, generous, warm-hearted, doesn't demonize even the adversaries in the subjects' lives. So it's he's I hope he gets back on track. The last one, not so good at any price. The farm story starring Dennis Quaid, a little bit of a misstep, but he's made the majority of his work has been excellent.
You are listening to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson alongside Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune, and we are listing our top five movies about immigration. We're up to our number three picks. Michael, what do you have in that slot?
My number three is The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada from director Tommy Lee Jones, who also stars in it. His key collaborator here is the screenwriter Guillermo Arriaga. And it's this kind of, I think it's actually kind of a stealth American classic. It's not a film that got any kind of pop when it opened here, but critically it got a really good ride, especially in Europe. And it's not really realism, but it's really kind of better than that. It's a story where Jones plays a Texas rancher who's one of his employees, Melquiades Estrada, the title, is trying to earn enough money to return to his family back in Mexico. He hasn't seen his wife or children in years. And early in the picture, and this is not really a spoiler because it is early, he's shot and killed by a Border Patrol rookie played by Barry Pepper. And so the three burials we hear about in the title, it's essentially we have the rancher and the Border Patrol guy taking this crazy journey back to Mexico on horseback, and they have the rotting corpse of the dead man, and it's really funny. It's allegorical. It's all kinds of things. But what it mainly is, I think, proof that you can take the Western genre and this notion, the scenario of a revenge killing, in a direction that doesn't. It is almost impossible to predict where this plot goes, and I find the film, you know, it tells a story indirectly of so many thousands and millions of people who are here. Yes, they're here illegally. And what are we going to do about it? But truly, as a human being, what are you going to do about it when you're confronted with one of these many, many, many stories of a human being caught in this situation? And I like this film a great deal. I've been touting this for years, and nobody knows it. Do you know it?
I do know it, and I think it was a bold choice for Jones to make as a directorial debut. I think he shows, you know, some strong instincts there, but I don't think the script serves him well. And it may be a problem I have with other scripts by Arriaga. He did 21 Grams, and there are these fractured narratives.
Okay, but that's not here. But there's not much of that here.
There isn't much, but there's enough of it
that it seems to be working against
Jones' instincts as director. I like the film enough, and I see the potential, and I certainly see why people do gravitate towards it and do see something fresh in terms of the Western in it. So, it's definitely, if you have not seen it, worth checking out. That is for sure. For my number three pick, I'm going to go with West Side Story. And I say that even though every time I think about West Side Story, just think about the concept of it, I sort of cringe. I mean, it just sounds so cheesy. And it's sort of I go back to that instinctual reaction I may have had as like a 14-year-old kid about musicals. It's like, oh, that sounds like the worst. West Side Story, it just sounds like the worst. I mean, think about the premise. You've got a riff on Romeo and Juliet, but it involves these dancing street gangs, right? And I don't think dance fights should exist anywhere outside of a Will Ferrell movie. That's probably the best place for them. The very names
come on,
of the
Jerome Robbins. Come on.
I'll get to that. Right. I mean, but even before the choreography, just think about the names of the gangs, the Jets and the Sharks. And then you've got the prospect of Natalie Wood as a Puerto Rican teen is not very promising. But you're right. You're exactly right about the Jerome Robbins choreography. And when I do get around to watching the film again, I realize – none of that matters. And this is such a delight. It throws all of those hurdles aside. And the acrobatic choreography is certainly a part of that. It's probably the highlight of the film for me. Mm. Although you do have the wonderful Bernstein and Sondheim songs, including perfectly for this top five, America.
Lots of new housing with more space.
Lots of doors slamming in our face.
I'll get a terrace apartment.
Better get rid of your accent.
Life can be bright in America.
If you can fight in America.
Life is all right in America.
If you're all white in America.
It's, you know, this punchy group duet, really, and you have the dreams and the harsh realities of the immigrant experience bouncing back and forth against each other. Really great number. It's something of a musical evocation of the conflicting convictions that new immigrants have and also the emotions that must be taking place. In the head of someone who's coming to a country expecting smooth sailing, that promised dream, but instead they run up against poverty and prejudice and things like that. So West Side Story, it always wins me over again and again.
I think the tragic hero is really the druggist played by Ned Glass.
Oh, yeah?
Kids, you make the world lousy.
That is a great part. What do you have for your number two, Michael?
My number two is a film called Sugar, another film I've always kind of trying to get people to see if they haven't seen it, from writer-directors Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, who made Half Nelson. And this is a story about a 19-year-old from the Dominican Republic who makes his way to Arizona and then to Iowa. And he's just kind of picked up by the fictional Kansas City Knights farm team. And he's a very promising baseball player. And what happens to this kid, Miguel Azucar, Sugar, Santos, really, to me, because the story does not follow the expected arc into kind of eventual triumph and a major league contract.
Yeah. It's, let alone the World Series.
World Series, and he doesn't hit the lights out like Robert Redford right. in The Natural. This film, I think, is just one of the truest, best sports films I've seen in decades, and it just reminds you constantly of the percentages of these young kids face, whether they're coming from the, you know, the DR or wherever. And by the end of the picture, which I won't give away too much, but by the end, when you're getting the filmmakers just kind of turn their camera to real people, not characters in the film, but real people that they find in New York, to kind of just briefly address the camera and kind of remind you that how many other stories there are like this man, Sugar's. I don't know. It's one slice of the American experience, and it's one of my favorite films of the last really 10, 15 years.
It's interesting you name it as a great sports film, because I think it's a very dark sports film.
Very.
I mean, in terms of it almost portrays professional sports as dishonest enterprise in a way, at least in how it can chew up and spit out people like
but
the
he's
main
not,
character.
Here's what I like about it, though. It's not that he just runs afoul of a bunch of openly unscrupulous or venal characters. It's mm-hmm. just, he has some, I don't want to give it too much away, he has some bad luck, and some of it's just simply physical and some of it's mental. And a lot of it just has to do with about the harsh challenge of adjusting to what the hell it's like to be in this new country and hardly know the language.
Yeah, Sugar. I like that Iowa sequence, too. There's some real cross-cultural great scenes in that one as well. My number two is a documentary. It's God Grew Tired of Us. And this is one of a handful of documentaries that came out a few years back about the Lost Boys of Sudan, the young men who fled fighting in Sudan and then eventually came to the United States. It was released in 2006. The directors are Christopher Quinn and Tommy Walker. And this focuses on a group of these refugees as they try to establish a new life in upstate New York after they wandered through the Sahara and then spent 10 years in a refugee camp in Kenya. Eventually, they end up in the U.S. Their experience in the United States, it does prove to be dispiriting as well, though. Nearly all of them find that they have to work two or in some cases even three jobs just to be able to afford the necessities of a Western lifestyle. So things like a car or a mobile phone. That's what it takes just to get that stuff. Despite some bleakness, there's also some comic observations about America, seeing it through their eyes, including some confusion over what Santa Claus has to do with Christmas. This is like a new concept to them. Don't quite get that.
Is Santa also in the Bible?
Never.
That is Xenakos. The Xenakos.
And how does it connect it with the birth of Jesus Christ? I think many of us have so many questions to ask, but I think we have few people to answer them.
Mostly, though, it works, I think, as an indictment of American individualism as experienced through their eyes. One man laments at one point that he can't ask strangers for directions because everyone seems to walk around in their own little bubble of fear. Hmm. And he can't even just do that common thing, wondering where he is and how he can get somewhere. Another man longingly recalls the group camaraderie he used to feel with his fellow Sudanese, even when they were fleeing for their lives. And I think that's a key one, because one of the tough questions this documentary forces us to ask is, what does it say about the American society we've created that it makes war-scarred visitors miss their refugee camp? I mean, that's kind of what you hear when these guys do talk about their experience. So God Grew Tired of Us, it's a tough, really eye-opening documentary. That's my number two pick.
I have not seen that film, and now I will.
Good, good. Yeah, it's well worth it. Well worth it.
Good.
What'd you have at your number one, Michael?
Man, this is tough. I mean, I monkeyed around with so many different titles. I thought of Kazan's America, America. I thought of the Stephen Frears film, My Beautiful Laundrette, which is a great slice of Thatcher-era London and all its kind of multicultural glory. The Immigrants in the New Land. I mean, El Norte. There's a lot of them. But I went for probably the most obvious one, which is The Godfather Part II, because I think it's probably one of the great pop culture immigration stories. And because I'm one of the people who I'm in the camp that believes the second Godfather picture to be really kind of a considerably greater achievement than the first one, because it's so artfully interweaves so many different timelines and so many different characters, slices of the immigrant experience about what it's like to come through Ellis Island as an orphan boy, essentially, what that must look like to young eyes, this whole kind of teeming Lower East Side thing, which, again, I don't know if you've seen it lately, Josh, but the way Coppola and his designers recreated the Lower East Side, it's just, it remains one of the great achievements in modern filmmaking, just to give you that convincing a slice of the past. He had a big budget to work on. We're not talking, this is the opposite of what
different James, than the immigrant,
James
right?
Gray and the Immigrant. But the effect is similar. You just, it's not that it was so rosy and I wish I was back there. I wish I lived those years. I wish I lived that person, Vito Corleone's story. You don't feel that necessarily, but what you feel is kind of the thrill and the danger and the seduction of what these American dreams promise people, and what they, you know, in the Mario Puzo universe of The Godfather and the mythology we all know so well, what it paid off in spades for a lot of these people, but at a huge price. And that's why I like The Godfather 2, because it does give you, it doesn't let the audience off the hook like the first one did. Because you really basically felt like, hey, they're looking out for each other in the first one. But the second one, just because of the way it bears down on Pacino's really kind of dead behind the eyes look after he's killed his brother and everything. You know, I mean, it's the cost of doing business with that family. But I love it. I never seem to tire of that second Godfather film. And it almost makes up for the fact that the third one is lousy.
What is your name? Come on, son. What is your name?
Tuo nome. Vito Andolini from Corleone.
Corleone. Vito Corleone. Okay. Over there.
Godfather Part 2 is in the Pantheon. Part 3, not in the Pantheon.
Good.
But that means I could not have chosen Part 2, so I'm glad you did, Michael. I do have another major filmmaker like Coppola represented with my number one, and it is also a film that shares the title of the movie we reviewed. It's The Immigrant. It's Chaplin's short from 1917. The first half of this takes place actually on a crowded boat that's packed with bedraggled immigrants en route to America. I think an early shot is of the Statue of Liberty. And even though it has that reverential image in it, and even though Chaplin has a reputation largely as a sentimentalist, this is a pretty bleak depiction of the immigrant experience here. On this boat, the officials, they brusquely use a rope to kind of herd the passengers into a corner at one point. I mean, it's very clear that they're considered cattle, essentially. And then when they are let through, it's one by one to go through this formal process of documentation before they can get off the boat. So it's not exactly a warm welcome. When the movie does transition to New York City streets, it's really abrupt and harsh. We just get this title card that says Hungry and Broke. And actually, an alternative title for this short was just Broke. And the next image we see is the tramp alone on the street, separated from, you know, there's a sense of some sense of community on the boat. And even that's gone here. He's alone. He's scrounging for change. Of course, this does have plenty of humor as well, and some of it is born of the idea of the tramp being this fish out of water, adjusting to new customs. There's a running gag involving his hat when he finally does make it into a restaurant. The waiter keeps wanting him to take it off. He wants to keep it on. So that goes back and forth.
Yeah. Well, in the shot you mentioned about where they're actually held back with a rope, that comes right after this moment where they're all kind of yearningly looking at the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah,
oh, there she is.
You know? Right.
And we're here. And then it's like, you know, get in line.
It gets undercut. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's really, and I mean, Chaplin, when you think about, he was already the first international movie star of that size in the movies. He was the first one. And by the time The Immigrant came out in 1917, you know, he knew, in a way, you know, that his audience was as big as the world. And this story and the way it's told and just kind of the identification everybody felt with this character was just something the movies had never seen that kind of power before. And the fact that it came through with really kind of how hostile and funny a persona that little tramp is, you know, the Chaplin's, and you know, he's an astonishing actor. That's all you can, it sounds kind of reductive to say that, Josh, I think the Chaplin was a great actor, but that's what he really was, first and foremost. I mean, he really sold the emotional aspect of that story.
Oh, yeah.
What it's like to be, you know, broke and hungry.
I mean, my favorite moment of the film is one of very small acting. It's not this big physical comedy. The tramp meets this woman on the boat, played by Edna Purviance, and she's there with her mother, and her mother has lost the money that was in her coat jacket. So the tramp, who's just won some money gambling, slips a pack of bills into the jacket and then looks away so that they don't notice him. And then he pauses and sort of sticks his hand back and pulls a few bills out for himself. And it's a great gag, but the acting too, it expresses this idea of this is a guy who's desperate. He's economically desperate as well. And also it's a recurring thread with Chaplin, right? Romance and economics are linked very much. So yeah, if you haven't seen the Immigrant.
It's a seminal immigration film.
It is for me. So that is my number one. And those are our top five movies about immigration. You mentioned a couple that I'm sure were honorable mentions, Michael, that you considered. Do you have any more besides that run of titles you gave us that were up? You mentioned El Norte. Did you say Dirty Pretty Things? Or
oh, I like that film a lot,
okay,
too. Yeah, yeah. Frears is made too.
You mentioned the other Frears.
Yeah, I think Dirty Pretty Things is very, it's also particularly good if you like the work of Chiwetel Ejiofor. Was the star of 12 Years a Slave, and that was when he was primarily a stage actor, but Dirty Pretty Things, if you haven't seen it, is proof in a way, that, in the same way The Godfather Part Two is, that you can take these serious and pressing and topical issues of immigration and use them honorably in the form of all kinds of genres, you know, thrillers of all kinds. And that's one of them. I like Dirty Pretty Things a lot.
Well, I did have a few other honorable mentions I want to get to. My regret, I should say, for this list is that I did not see America, America, Kazan's 1963 film. Just couldn't find 3 hours to fit that one in, but I know I do need to get to that. Real Women Have Curves. This was a charming 2002 film that features a Mexican-American immigrant family. America Ferrera was in that. It was sort of her breakout
film.
Right,
right. I saw the play. It was a play first. Yeah.
Was it? Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's worth checking out. Once, the 2007 word of mouth Irish musical.
Oh, I love
hit.
That film, man.
That would have counted here.
Good idea.
We actually considered a Massacre Theater related to this, where I believe Adam was going to play an instrument and I was going to sing. Thankfully, everyone's been spared that, including you, Michael, because if we had done this for this show, you would have been right here suffering in the studio.
Would go back. You know, she would leave Dublin if she hasn't already.
And I wouldn't blame her. A few more quickly to list here. The Namesake, Gangs of New York, The Visitor, and Fast Food Nation, I considered as well. Very close, possibly my number six, the Dardenne brothers, Lorna's Silence.
Good one, good one. I got to argue with on Gangs in New York. For me, that is one of the weaker of Scorsese's.
Weaker than The Wolf of Wall Street? Because I know you didn't really care for that either.
Yeah, I don't like that. Yeah, I find that one just almost undigested and undigestible. I mean, despite Daniel Day-Lewis's you know, real presence and formidable. You know, but there's nothing else in that film, I believe. I don't believe anything.
I would have to revisit it. I remember being wowed by the ambition and some of the performances at the time. But yeah. It's deserving of a revisit for sure. But I did consider for this list. Those are our top five movies about immigration. We want to hear your picks as well, or any other comments you have about the show. Please send those to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail. We were able to play a few in bonus content recently. So if you want to send us that, give us a call at 312-264-0744. Of course, you can find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and at Facebook.com/FilmSpotting. All right, wide release this weekend. It's pretty much the sequels, Michael. Looks like 22 Jump Street with Channing Tatum, Jonah Hill. It's from the Lego Movie directors Phil Lord and Christopher Miller. We also have How to Train Your Dragon 2. This is a sequel to the critically acclaimed 2010 film and gets Michael's seal of approval. A few limited release openings here in Chicago. At the Gene Siskel Center is Citizen Coke, documentary that follows the money behind the rise of the Tea Party. Documented, appropriately enough for this show, is a doc about undocumented immigrants. And The Human Scale, another documentary. This is about life in the world's megacities. Over at Facets, they are having the 12th annual Chicago African Diaspora Film Festival. And at Music Box Theater, a couple of films. We want to mention The Case Against the Eight, a documentary about overturning California's same-sex marriage ban. Kelly Reichardt's Night Moves. This stars Jesse Eisenberg, Dakota Fanning, and Peter Sarsgaard. And Obvious Child, which has been tagged the abortion romantic comedy, stars Jenny Slate. And I think this also gets your seal of approval. Is that right,
really
Michael?
Good. It's really good. And it's already kind of fighting that handle. It's not inaccurate to call it a rom-com with... about an abortion, but it's
maybe more than that as well.
A lot more than that. And Slate's great. Yeah.
All right. Well, next week, we're still working out the details. Adam's going to be back, and there are a handful of promising smaller films we're considering reviewing. Obvious Child is one of them. Night Moves is one of them. Maybe even David Michaud's The Rover. We're still working that out, which means the top five is up in the air as well. So suggestions.
So many riches.
There are so many riches. We hope they all look promising. Send your suggestions for top five ideas related to any of those films, and we might be able to pull that off. Michael, thanks again for joining me this week, and tell us what listeners can look forward to reading from you over at chicagotribune.com/movies.
I mean, this week it's you got the March of the Sequels, and you got the Obvious Child, which I said is very good, and
that Channing Tatum apology in your 22 Jump Street review. That's the one I want to read.
It's a reframing of my original misjudgment.
Okay. Okay. I look forward to that.
It's part of my compilation of misjudgments.
Well, thanks again, Michael. I really appreciate it. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and to the members of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our music this week was from Rodney Crowell. There's more information about the new album, Tar Paper Sky, at rodneycrowell.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.